Well, it looks as though we are all assembled this morning. Before I call our first case for the day, we're going to do a little demonstration about how we keep time when we're doing oral argument by Zoom. So if you look in the upper left-hand corner of your screen, you will see when it's time to start, you will see a green sign saying start. When you have 5 minutes to go, there'll be a yellow sign telling you 5 minutes, yet. And then at the end, a red stop sign. I'll help you keep track of the signs just a bit because I know it's a little unusual and you get involved in your argument. But I pretty much hold you to the red stop sign unless you are answering a question from a justice, and then please complete your answer. But after the answer to that question is concluded, then we will move on. Are you both ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, very good. Then I will call our first case, State versus Schmidt. Attorney August, please begin.
May it please the court, my name is Christopher August. I represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Anthony Schmidt. I'm here ultimately asking this court to do two things: to vacate surcharges applied to Mr. Schmidt's read-in charges, and to remand for an evidentiary hearing on his plea withdrawal motion. In assessing this case, there's two independent legal issues presented for this court's review. First, whether the plain language of the child pornography surcharge statute permits the circuit court to impose a surcharge for a read-in. And second, whether the child pornography surcharge statute functions like a punishment and therefore must be explained to a defendant before accepting their plea. If so, this court must then ask or analyze whether Mr. Schmidt's motion sufficiently alleged that he did not know or understand that information. Turning to the first point, the plain language of the statute makes clear that the circuit court exceeded its statutory authority when it imposed surcharges for read-ins. In support of that conclusion, there's three relevant pieces of evidence. First, and obviously most relevant, is the plain language of the statute in context. Second, there's this court's stated obligation to avoid surplusage when interpreting a statute. And third, there's a comparison with other similar sentencing statutes. Turning to the first piece of evidence, as I stated, the most relevant, I think the most important piece of evidence, is the language of the statute itself. Obviously, when we're interpreting a statute, we're engaged in a process of active listening. The legislature is speaking to us through the words in the text, and it's our obligation to, as faithfully as possible, capture the meaning of those words. In order to do that, we can't take phrases or words out of context and look at them in a vacuum. We need to look at the entire utterance, as it were. And so in this case, we're dealing with one sentence in 973-04-042 sub 2, and it states that if the court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation, then the court shall impose a child pornography surcharge for each image, quote, associated with the crime. And so I think what's really important to note about this statute is it begins and it ends with this concept of the crime in this case being possession of child pornography. And it tells us that this is only activated if that conditional phrase is satisfied. If the court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation, then it needs to impose a surcharge connected with that crime. And so when we look at that statute, when we look at that language, there's just no room in the legislature's words for a read-in. Because as we know from statutory as well as common law, a series of decisions from this court, Strauss-Kowski, Frye, Sulla, and others, read-ins are their own unique legal concept in Wisconsin law. They occupy their own legal category. I think in the Frye court, a read-in was defined as a sentencing mechanism that's often used in plea negotiations. And so it's obviously not possible for a circuit court to place a person on probation for a read-in. It's obviously not possible to impose a sentence for a read-in because, as stated, they're their own independent special legal category. And so when we look at that, just looking at the plain language and understanding what a read-in is, as I stated, there's just no room in the statute for the read-in. This flows into the second relevant piece of evidence, which is this court's stated obligation. The case cited in the brief is the Lake City Corporation case, to avoid surplusage. And this kind of goes back to what I was talking about previously, that we're engaged in a process of active listening. We're listening to what the legislature is telling us. And if an interpretation that we choose results in some of those words becoming superfluous, then that's a signal that we have not faithfully captured the meaning or the proper interpretation of the statute. And so when we look at the state's urged for interpretation in this case, I think it's clear that it would render that important conditional phrase that starts that sentence, it would render that superfluous. In other words, if the state is correct and the Court of Appeals in the Kuhn case is correct, then that initial phrase stating if the court places someone on probation or imposes a sentence becomes meaningless. Because if we're going to say that the circuit court is empowered when sentencing someone and when imposing a surcharge to consider anything that's mentally connected, whether it be dismissed outright, dismissed and read in, conduct maybe that's not even alleged in a complaint, maybe other conduct that arises in some other conduct and context, then we've really read that phrase out of the statute, which again links the surcharge tightly with the imposition of a sentence.
Or Mr. August, doesn't your reading then read out the last sentence of 973.042(2). That is, that sentence says that a court shall determine the number of images or copies of images associated with the crime by a preponderance of the evidence. And so what would that phrase mean? What would that sentence mean if it doesn't apply to read-ins? I don't understand how it would apply to charges for which the defendant was convicted, because those, of course, had to have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, right? The judge has to, they're entering a plea or found guilty at jury trial. So what images would a judge be looking at to make the preponderance finding if not dismissed and read in charges?
So this is the point that I think the state brought up in their response, and I addressed this in my reply. And when we're discussing the concept of surplusage, I think it's clear that language doesn't become surplusage so long as we can say that it applies under at least some circumstances. And so when we look at the decision cited, the Multaylor and the Whistleman case, I think it's clear that a prosecutorial entity has the discretion to charge the child pornography offense in different ways. I think it's clear that the most common and expected way that we would see it would be one image, one count. I think that's how it's usually treated. But as those cases discuss, a prosecutorial entity could choose a different charging theory. For example, if a defendant possesses one thumb drive, a prosecutor in their discretion would have authority to charge that person with one charge of child pornography related to the singular thumb drive. And under those circumstances, under that charging theory in a case that presented those facts, then the court would have to proceed to the second sentence, because then there would be that factual question that would have to be resolved for the court of how many images are associated with the crime. So the court would essentially have to ask, state, you're charging this as a thumb drive. How many images are on the thumb drive in order for me to determine and fulfill the statutory guidance here?
Counsel, just beyond that example, I was trying to look at some of the other statutes and just wanted to see how they would apply as well. Because this statute applies for not just, possession of child pornography, but also, for example, 948.05, sexual exploitation of a child, right? And so I want to make sure I'm understanding other situations, how that second sentence might apply as well, and want to make sure I have your understanding on it. So, for example, 948.05 talks about For example, you could be charged for producing or performing or even profiting from a recording of a child engaging in sexually explicit conduct. So my guess would be under a statute like that, you could have someone who's charged under 948.805 for, say, selling a thumb drive full of recordings, and they could be charged maybe with one count of this violation for profiting from it, right? But there might be multiple underlying images that were ultimately sold. And I think your theory is, if I'm understanding correctly, then the court would need to go through in that context and sort of determine how many images there are for purposes of the surcharge. Is that right? Is that how that would work?
That's correct. So that's another circumstance where if the prosecutor chose to exercise their prosecutorial discretion in that different way, then yes, that second sentence would become relevant to the inquiry at sentencing. So then there are situations in which that sentence would apply, meaning it's not surplusage. Versus the state's reading, I think if that's correct, then really that initial phrase about placing someone on probation or imposing a sentence does become superfluous. I don't see a way in which that language really matters under the state's reading. And I think that that's problematic because, again, the legislature has spoken to us in a specific way, and the interpretation that we choose has to give effect to all of their words.
August, couldn't the first part of that sentence just be read to mean we don't even get to this issue unless there is the person is convicted of a crime? I mean, if a court imposes a sentence or places a person on probation for a crime under this section, then the court shall impose the child pornography surcharge for each image or copy of an image associated with the crime. So there has to be a crime for which the person is sentenced. But why are you saying that can't include a read-in? That there can't also be a read-in attached to that crime?
So I understand the point, and I think this is the state's point, which is that this is just capturing a procedural reality, possibly. But I think when you look at the structure of the sentence, it's talking about actually placing someone on probation or imposing a sentence. And then it's linking the images associated with the crime for which that person is placed on probation or sentenced. And so I think when you read those clauses together, I think it's a strained reading to say that this is just simply simply saying if you're conducting a sentencing hearing, then you get to this second part of the statute. I think if that's the case, the legislature could have chosen language to say at sentencing. I don't know why the legislature would have chosen the specific phraseology that it did in this case, if that was its intent. So, and I also think when we look at similar statutes, I think that's really helpful in determining how to read this, because as we know, in other sentencing statutes, the legislature is perfectly capable of telling us when it wants a circuit court to conduct a broader or more wide-ranging inquiry. And I think this also, to some extent, gets into a concept of judicial restraint, which, after all, we're talking about what powers the legislature is giving to the circuit court. And I don't think it's unreasonable to assert that if we're going to give the circuit court very broad powers, which I think the circuit court has incredibly broad powers under the reading in Kuhn to impose potentially hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars worth of surcharges, then we need a really clear signal from the legislature that that's what they want to have happen. And they didn't give it to us in this statute, but they have in other statutes, right? So for example, in the sentence credit statute is a really good example. That's another mandatory duty of the circuit court at sentencing is to determine the days of credit. And in making that inquiry, the legislature has been very clear that it wants the circuit court to consider the entire course of conduct underlying the sentence. And that, of course, has resulted in case law that says you consider days that you sat in jail for a charge that's dismissed and read in based on the explicit choice of language that the legislature made. You know, similarly with restitution, we know that one of the things that give the restitution or that give read-ins impose restitution for read-ins. But number two, in a series of Court of Appeals cases, Kennedy and the cases that follow, as well as to a lesser extent, some of this court's cases, there's other language in the restitution statute that the courts have interpreted to stand for broader authorizing language to look at, you know, whether there's a nexus between some conduct and what's being considered at sentencing. And we don't have that language being used in this statute. Instead, we have very specific language being used, which talks about if you're placing someone on probation, you're imposing a sentence for a crime, then you impose a surcharge for images associated with that crime. So again, under the Graziano case that's cited in my brief, we can assume that the legislature knew how to do this, and the fact that it didn't do it in this case is notable from a statutory construction standpoint. So for those reasons, I think that the plain language just clearly does not permit what occurred here, and for that reason, those surcharges applied to read-ins need to be vacated. Now, turning to the second issue, and an independent and to some extent alternative issue in this case, concerns more broadly how the child pornography surcharge statute operates and whether it operates like a regulation or whether it operates like a punishment. Here, I would concede that we do not have direct proof that the legislature intended this to be a punishment, to be a fine. But I think it's clear when we look at how the surcharge functions, and especially under the reading advocated for by the state and under the reading in the persuasive but citable Kuhn case, I think it's clear that the surcharge functions like a punishment. And in reaching that analysis, I think that there's four relevant pieces of evidence or four relevant considerations. It applies to conduct that's already a crime. In context of the other punishments that are already meted out to child pornography offenders, it imposes an affirmative disability or restraint. It promotes the traditional aims of deterrence and retribution. And it does not have a rational connection to regulatory aims and, in fact, is excessive to those regulatory aims. And so—
Mr. August, I really want to talk to you about your argument about it being excessive. This money goes, the surcharge goes to two purposes, right? It goes number one for the investigation of child exploitation and child pornography, correct?
That's correct.
Yes. The second place it goes is to make sure that the SAVES grant, the Sexual Assault Victim Services grant in this state, is funded, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And there, that SAVES grant allows, it's $2 million, right? Every biennium. Is that right? I'll just tell you, because I was in charge of that grant, the answer is yes. And do you know what that money goes for?
I know under the statute that it's targeted towards actual victims of these offenses, and it's to provide services to organizations that provide.
Yeah, it's so that every county, 72 counties in this state, have at least one person per county, and I think the maximum per in any county, because there isn't enough money in this fund, is three sexual assault victim service providers. So people to help assist victims of sexual assault get the services and the help and the support that they need. And I just have a hard time understanding how you think it's excessive when the SAVES grant is underfunded at least by 100%, if not more, every 2 years.
So I think when we look at the excessiveness inquiry, we have to look at the statute on its face, and we have to look at how the statute could be interpreted on its face. That doesn't necessarily always correspond directly to how perhaps entities have been applying it or what monies are actually being collected from it, but at least the potential for revenue to be collected from this statute. So I think number one, I would assert that especially under the Kuhn reading and the state's reading, when we're talking about a statute that has the capability, as I put forth in my brief, in a case like Mr. Schmitz, to net, you know, millions of dollars potentially in liability for one offender, I think we are dealing with a statute that is excessive. And we're also dealing with a statute that doesn't have a strictly rational connection here, that I would assert it's not rational for single offenders to bear that high of a regulatory load, as it were.
I'm having a hard time understanding how you, the disconnect that you are seeing. A child, you know what, I mean, child pornography is grown-ups sexually assaulting children. These videos are horrific. The ones that I have had to watch, these kids are crying for their parents. It is the most egregious offense that you could possibly witness. And so how could you say that there's not a rational connection between that and providing services to these victims and providing services to sexual assault victims? I'm not understanding that argument at all.
So I guess in response to the justice's question, I guess I would just note that, number one, we're not asking this surcharge to be stricken, to be struck down. But also, we're asking whether this is a regulation or it's a punishment. And I guess if we're going to start discussing the propriety of the regulation in terms of, you know, how horrific the crime is, or how morally blameworthy the actors are, or whether the actors deserve to pay a certain amount of money because of the emotional toll caused by an observer of the videos, we're not talking about a regulation anymore. We've ceased to talk about a regulation, and instead we're talking about a punishment. And if we're talking about a punishment, that's fine. If this is serving a punitive aim to make sure that these offenders, who their conduct is egregious and morally blameworthy, pay, have a financial harm as a result of their conduct, that's fine. There's no way in which the statute is going to be struck down on that basis. All I'm asking is, if that's what this statute is doing, that we're upfront about that, and we inform a defendant about that before they plead guilty. That would be the only result that would occur in this case. And then we can continue to collect the funds from them. We can continue to impose the surcharge.
Well, Mr. August, we're talking about a $500 surcharge. I mean, there's no doubt, and no one at this hearing today or watching this hearing is going to argue that it is a morally reprehensible crime. But if we were going to mete out a dollar amount to reach, that would be equal to how morally reprehensible this crime is, it would certainly be more than $500.
Well, and respect.
If we chart people who are involved in OWI seconds, pay more than that.
Well, respectfully, I don't believe it is a $500 surcharge. It's a $500 surcharge per image. And so in this case, it was not a $500 surcharge. It was a $7,000 surcharge. In the McDonald case that's pending in the Court of Appeals, and which has stayed pending this case, I believe it was a $50,000 surcharge. I don't recall precisely how many thousands of dollars Kuhn was facing. So it's not just a $500 surcharge. And we have to look at the total financial liability created in the statute. And so especially under a reading that's urged for by the Court of Appeals and the state, which would impose much broader liability, we're looking at tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars of financial liability. And so again, if the question is, does $500 equate to the moral blameworthiness of their actions? We're not talking about a regulation. We're talking about a punishment. And again, if we're talking about a punishment, this court has been clear in the Brown case and several other cases, that if it's a punishment, we need to tell the defendant about it before they plead guilty.
I'm sorry, finish your sentence. I thought you were taking a pause.
No, I'm done, Your Honor.
as I understand your position, you are not disagreeing with the premise that there may be a rational connection to a non-punitive aim here. Non-punitive in terms of what the statute speaks of, the investigation costs, et cetera. But that your argument is that the imposition of the surcharge is excessive to that non-punitive aim. Am I correct with regard to that understanding?
I think it's primarily that it's excessive, but I also think that there's a degree of the rationality analysis that plays into, for example, if we're going to increase by 500 for every single image. And I don't think that that's a strictly rational connection because, again, for example, if someone has a zip file on their computer with 500 images, they copy that into another location on their computer, and now they've got 1,000 images. Has that person created another 500 surcharges, 500 times 500 worth of costs that we need to balance in a regulatory fashion? I don't know that that's strictly rational. But again,
counsel, here, as I understand it, you advance that there is potentially 4,500 images that could have been charged, $2,250,000 worth. Is that what your argument is based on, that kind of hypothetical rather than the reality here of $7,000 in total?
So to answer very briefly, I think that the cases discussing whether it's a punishment or a regulation require us to look at the statute on its face and determine how it could be applied, not how it's as applied in this circumstance. I think that that's from Williams and the Scruggs case have established that.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Attorney Mullenbach, are you prepared to proceed?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Chief please Justice. May it please the court. My name is Eric Mullenbach, and I represent the state of Wisconsin. As my opposing counsel pointed out, there are two issues associated with this case, but I think the primary question here is whether the 8 read-in images that petitioner agreed to as part of his guilty plea were associated with his crimes. Just to make it clear, this is not a case in which the circuit court imposed the surcharge on images beyond the agreed-upon read-ins. And therefore, while it's certainly important to consider the various million-dollar scenarios that are raised in petitioner's brief, this court does not need to resolve those scenarios in order to resolve this specific case.
Attorney Mullenbach, go ahead, Justice.
No, please.
Okay, thank you. I just want to pick up where Attorney August left off. If we're supposed to look at this on its face, what is ever to limit the state from actually seeking, in this case, 8,000 images, right? 4,000 that was deleted and 4,000 that were there. So there could have been a surcharge of 8,000 for 8,000 images. So isn't that at some point, doesn't that rise to a level of punishment? And if it always could be, and we look at it on its face, why should we accept the statute as not being punitive?
Well, I would agree. I think that at some point the surcharge or the amount of surcharge may become punitive. I would just, again, remind the court that's not the case here. Nonetheless, I think there are several limiting factors that would apply here, some legal limiting factors and some pragmatic or maybe natural limiting factors. And I think the statute itself, the operation of the statute itself is one of those limiting factors. As was discussed previously, in order for the surcharge to apply here, the court needs to find by a preponderance of the evidence that the images are in fact associated with the crime. What that means is the state would have to provide the court with sufficient evidence in order to make that determination.
That wouldn't be too hard with respect to the 4,000 images, right?
Well, I think it would be. I mean, I think in this case, with respect to the read-ins, which is what we're talking about in this case, but with respect to the read-ins, there was sufficient information contained in the complaint, contained in the information at the plea agreement. The petitioner admitted that the state could meet its burden of establishing that the images that formed the basis of those read-ins were in fact child pornography and that he possessed those images. But with respect to the uncharged crimes or the uncharged images, which would amount to all of them except for the 14 that were charged. There was no evidence before the judge in which to make that determination. So I think that would be a pragmatic limiting factor. And I think a subset or a sub issue related to that would be judicial economy and just the time that it would take to go through 8,000 or 4,000 images. You know, like I said, the judge is required to make a determination by a preponderance of the evidence that these images are associated with. So the judge would have to either view the images or view a description of those images in order to make that determination and then determine whether or not they're associated with. So if the judge take 5 or 4,000 images, for example, if the judge just took 5 minutes to review each one of those images or each one of the descriptions of those images, and the judge reviewed those, like I said, for 5 minutes and worked an 8-hour day, it would take that judge approximately 41 days to go through all 4,000 of those images. I mean, that just isn't reasonable. I understand that, yes, it is, I guess, theoretically possible that the state would ask for 4,000 images to be, you know, subject to the surcharge, but I don't think pragmatically that would ever happen. I think that's extremely unlikely. I think another limiting principle, as far as a legal limiting principle is concerned here, would be the Eighth Amendment. At some point in time, the excessive fines clause would probably kick in. Again, that's not an issue that that the petitioner raises here, but I think that that's possibly one of the limiting factors that could apply in this case. And I think there are some other pragmatic or natural limitations that would apply in these cases. In this particular case, for example, all the images that were found, well, the 4,000 or 4,500 images that were referred to in the complaint were all found on the same phone that the petitioner hid at his place of work. I think that to the extent that there may be different devices, you know, that the images are found on, that could be a potential limiting factor. In this case, there was evidence that the same email, the same IP address was used in order to download and upload these images. If there were different email addresses or different IP addresses used, that again, that could be another potential limiting factor in these cases or in other cases, not in this case, but possibly in other cases in the future. So I think there are some limiting factors here that would apply. And again, you know, that what we're dealing with here is, you know, a surcharge on 14 images and a $7,000 surcharge. So I don't think, you know, I certainly don't believe, and the state doesn't believe that rises to the level of punishment in this case.
Mr. Mulbach, can you respond to Attorney August's argument that, you know, hey, we've got the restitution statute, and then I'm talking about the read-ins. The restitution statute is very clear that read-in charges, a judge can impose restitution on read-in charges, and that language is not as clear in 973.042 sub 2.
Correct. And I think I addressed this briefly or a little bit in my brief. I think that the reason that it's not as clear, that the reason the legislature didn't expressly indicate in the child pornography surcharge that it would apply to read-ins is because they intended it to apply broader than that. They didn't want to just limit it to the basis of the image that formed the basis of the conviction, as my opposing counsel contends. They didn't want to limit it to read-in charges. They wanted to make it a little, you know, capture more images than that. They wanted to capture all images that are associated with the crime. And as the justice pointed out earlier, you know, associated with, or the language of that statute, you know, is connected to the crime, not to the sentence. You know, if the legislature wanted to limit these images to, you know, those that form the basis of the conviction, they could have easily done that. And in fact, they have done that on numerous occasions. For example, the DNA surcharge is a per conviction surcharge. The drug offender diversion surcharge is the same. The victim witness surcharge is again the same. And the crime prevention funding board surcharge all are dependent upon conviction or counts. The legislature specifically chose not to limit the surcharge in this case to the basis of the images that form the basis of the conviction or to images that form the basis of the read-in counts. They intended to make it broader. And again, I think like Justice Kurofsky pointed out earlier, the reason for that is, you know, the more images, the more harm these individuals do, the more the costs go up with respect to, you know, not only the harm or damage that these, child pornography does to the victims. It does harm and damage to society generally. And, you know, obviously providing victim services to sexual assault victims, extremely important. And as I pointed out in my brief, that can sometimes lead to lifelong problems. So, I think that they wanted this well funded. That obviously is the intended purpose. So I think that's the reason that the legislature didn't just tie it or didn't mimic the language that the restitution statute has as far as allowing it just to be applied to the read-ins.
Counsel, so which is it? It's limited. Don't worry. There are pragmatic limitations, as you say. You need to present evidence. Judicial economy is a limitation. Legally, the Eighth Amendment is a limitation. So don't worry, court. That's what you said 5 minutes ago. In response to this question, you say, well, sky's the limit, it seems like. If the legislature wanted to capture all images associated with the crime, doesn't have to be the charged offense, doesn't have to be the read-in offense. It can be all uncharged offenses, potentially here, I suppose. It's not clear what number we're dealing with. Is it? I think the PSI said up to 8,500. You had me when you said it was limited, because I don't want it unbridled. And now you tell me it's unlimited. So put my mind at ease. Which one is it?
Well, I don't think what I'm trying to argue that it's unlimited as far as the number of surcharges that can be imposed. I think it's that does have limits. I think, like I said before, both legally and pragmatically. I think when it comes to the unlimited, where it does not have a limit, maybe I should say, is that it's not limited to the images that form the basis of the conviction or to the images that form the basis of the reading counts. It can apply to images perhaps that are not included in the information, included in the criminal complaint.
It can potentially apply to up to 8,500, if that number is correct. If that's not the correct number, it's closer to 4,500. I had both numbers that I read.
The record wasn't exactly clear on that. Essentially, what I think the record reflected was there was about anywhere from 4,000 to 4,500 that were contained on the phone that law enforcement recovered. And then there was some evidence that perhaps his girlfriend may have deleted 4,000 images, I believe, on a different device that he may or may not have possessed. So there's not exactly a clear indication as to how many images we're talking about here. But again, I think that sticking with the 4,500 images that were found on the phone that form the basis of these 14 images that were charged, I think that the statute does allow for the state to request the surcharge to be applied to not only the images that form the basis of the conviction, but also the images that form the basis of the read-in counts, and potentially if they wanted to. Again, that's not the issue here, but potentially if they wanted to, I think they probably could ask the surcharge to apply to uncharged counts. Now, again, the state would have to provide evidence to allow the judge to make the determination that's required under the statute that those images are in fact associated with the crime. Again, that would be, of course, that they're child pornography and that they were possessed by the petitioner. And I would also note here that even though there were 4,500 images that were found on the phone, there's also evidence in the record that not all 4,500 of those images were in fact child pornography. The images were, I believe, classified as erotica and child pornography. There was some indication that some of the images were of pictures of children's feet, of children, fully clothed. And while I certainly recognize that a fully clothed child certainly doesn't preclude it from being child pornography, not every image of a child qualifies as child pornography. And I think that's an important point here, because that is what the court is required to do. The court is required to take a look at these images or descriptions of the images, whatever evidence is required or needed in order to make that determination and to make sure that those images are in fact associated with the crime. And I think that's an important limiting factor. Like I said,
Counsel, I'm sorry, Justice Bradley, are you done with your question or did you want to follow on?
No, that's fine. Thanks.
Okay. Let me tell you a challenge I'm having with your position on the statute. If your position is sort of like the Court of Appeals position in the Keene case, if that's how it's pronounced, basically I hear you saying that we're not limited to anything that's read in. That may be what we have here, but that's not what associated with means something broader than that. So it could apply to anything related to that. We have a real problem that as far as I can tell, in that this is not an optional thing. The statute says that the court must impose the surcharge of $500 on every single image associated with the crime. That's not an optional duty. It doesn't actually seem to depend on the evidence that the state would offer. There is a mandatory requirement for the court to do it. And so if the circuit court could, under your theory, under the statute, impose a surcharge for 4,500 pictures, $500 each, or maybe some amount less than that, understanding the point you just made, but that's neither here nor there for my purposes here, then under the statute, it must, if your reading is correct. And so here's the difficulty I have with that. That doesn't appear to be, to me, what the statute says. And that shows to me that reading is not reasonable for at least a couple of reasons. And that is because we don't have a line of what it means to be associated with the crime. The only line here that seems to make sense as I read it, and I want to give you a chance to respond to this, is that it's actually with the crime you were convicted of, as your opposing counsel was saying. Then you have defined crimes that have been, somebody's been convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. You have a defined set of images that you're working with. And you impose the surcharge that way. A circuit court can work through that. And there's a defined world of plausible images here. But if it's not that, then it's the Wild West. And I'm not particularly persuaded by the second piece, that the circuit court's finding by preponderance of the evidence does anything here, because that just simply says the circuit court needs to figure out which of those 4,500 images is in fact child pornography and which one is not. It doesn't give that provision to me as I read it, doesn't seem to give the circuit court discretion to decide which images we think are close enough or to decide how many it wants to impose a surcharge for, or the state for that matter to decide which of those ones it wants to ask for a surcharge for. This is a mandatory court duty. So help me understand how this mandatory requirement should affect our reading, or if I'm reading this incorrectly, why that would be. I'm just curious your response to that.
Well, yes, I agree that the surcharge is mandatory after the court finds that the images are associated with. I don't think, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I don't think that the circuit court was under a duty here to view all 4,000 or 4,500 images to make that determination. There is a standard of review here, or a standard that must be met. So I think in order for the surcharge to apply, there has to be a request by the state. Then the state needs to provide enough or sufficient evidence for the court to make a determination as to whether or not those images are in fact associated with the crime. And then, yes, I think that if the court does determine that the standard has been met, those images are associated, then yes, I think that the statute is clear that the judge shall impose the surcharge.
Is that illegal? Is the preponderance of the evidence, is that a legal determination or a factual determination that the circuit court is making in your view? Well, it says the court shall determine the number of images or copies of images associated with the crime by preponderance of the evidence and without a jury. Is that a legal determination that this is associated with the crime, or is it a factual determination of the number of images? How is the circuit court supposed to figure that out?
Well, I think it's a factual determination, and I know that's how the Kuhn case treated it. And but there is still a standard that must be met. It must still meet the preponderance of the evidence standard.
Sure.
These images or the surcharge doesn't just automatically apply to the 4,000 images that are referred to in the criminal complaint here. There has to be some evidence to allow the judge to determine whether or not those images are a...
What about the complaint? What about the complaint?
Well, in this particular case, the complaint, not the affidavit supporting the complaint, the complaint actually did have not just passing reference to the images, it actually had descriptions, detailed descriptions of what the images contained. And I think that based on those descriptions that are contained in the complaint, contained in the information, and again, the fact that the petitioner in this case acknowledged that the state could meet their burden, beyond a reasonable doubt, certainly would suffice to allow a judge under those circumstances to conclude that those images are associated by a preponderance of the evidence.
So I don't disagree that it would suffice, but I'm curious about the mandatory portion. So what if you had a complaint that said, we found 4,500 images, all of these are images of child pornography. We're charging 10 counts and picking 10 images to charge for those specific crimes. My question to you is, and let's say there's no disputing that those 4,500 images are images of child pornography. Is the circuit court judge required to charge $500 for each of those 4,500 images under that fact scenario? Or does the circuit court have discretion to say that number is lower, or I'm going to pick some different number?
Well, again, I think that the fact that there's a reference in the complaint that 4,500 images may or may not contain child pornography, the complaint oftentimes is written by a law enforcement officer. And I don't think the judge could just conclude that because there is some, statement in that complaint that all 4,500 images contain child pornography, that would meet the standard of preponderance of the evidence that each individual image, in fact, does meet that standard, is in fact associated with the crime. I think that it's incumbent upon the judge in these cases to analyze the individual images, whether it's the image itself or some actual description of what the image contains. And I think that's where the important distinction comes in here.
So does the judge have a duty to go through each of the 4,500 images in my circumstance? The statute says the circuit court shall impose one for each image associated with the crime. So are the 4,500 images, in your view, plausibly associated with the crime? Does that create a duty on the court to determine the number? How would you, under your reading of the statute?
I don't think that the judge would have a duty based on that. I don't think the judge would have a duty to go through each of those 4,500 images to determine whether or not they are. I think that if the state presents the judge with sufficient evidence and makes the request, judge, can you review these to determine whether or not they are associated with the crime? And then the judge, in fact, does conclude that by a preponderance of the evidence that those images are associated with the crime, then the judge has an affirmative duty to impose the search.
Well, suppose the defendant doesn't dispute that the 4,500 images are child pornography. Does the judge have a duty to impose the surcharge for those 4,500 images?
Well, I think similar to, no, I don't think that would rise to the, that would be sufficient. I don't believe that the petitioner or a defendant admitting, a scenario that I can envision is an individual's confession to committing a crime in and of itself is generally not sufficient. You have to have some evidence supporting that confession. And here, I don't think you would have that. Even if the defendant admitted that, yes, in my view, these are child pornography. And again, I think this case is, I come back to the facts of this case. Not all these images appear to have been child pornography. I think, like I said, there were some images that were described as erotica, didn't rise to the level, from what I could tell, as being qualifying as child pornography.
So let me take it one step further. So let's say the state says, we want to get this guy. Here's 1,000 images. And we're going to provide you descriptions of them, or we're going to give the short court, we're going to give you access to those. Does the circuit court have a duty to impose that? If the circuit court have a duty to take that and impose the fine on all 1,000 images, or does the circuit court have discretion to not do that? And the circuit court is going to just pick the 1,000, not the 4,500, not the crimes actually convicted of.
Well, again, I would just remind the court that's not the situation that we have here.
I agree, but we do deal in hypotheticals. So, yeah, we need to actually read the statute and what it says. So
I understand. I'm not trying to avoid your question. I just want to make sure that, you know, that's not the case that we have here. But yes, I guess I would. It would seem to me that based on that hypothetical scenario, if the state presented the judge with 1,000 images, request the judge to review those 1,000 images to determine whether or not they are associated with the crime. I believe that hearing perhaps could occur. I think that those images probably should be reviewed to determine whether or not the surcharge would apply. Again, though, I find that a highly unlikely scenario given some of the limitations or, you know, some of the limiting factors that are in play here. You know, if you are looking at 1,000 images, it's going to take you days. Like I said, just looking at each image or each description of the image for 5 minutes, it's going to take you days, almost, you know, 2 weeks to go through each one of those images.
Counsel, I don't think it's going to necessarily take days or weeks. I think it's going to take 20 minutes. And it's because of this. I mean, I don't know why you say the judge has to go through each and every one of the 1,000 or the 4,000 or the 8,500. All you need is a 20-minute evidentiary hearing with qualified investigating officer who's investigated lots and lots and lots of these. And the investigating officer says, and the investigating officer sets forth the standard of child pornography in more detail than I know it when I see it, you know, sets forth limitations of what he or she says is child pornography, and then gives an opinion based on the experience that 1,000 fit, cross-examination. You know. But what makes you think that this statute, and then the court sits there and says, well, I find by a preponderance of evidence, duly qualified expert. Not beyond a reasonable doubt, preponderance of evidence. What makes you think that this statute requires the judge to spend 5 minutes looking at these 1,000 each one in the 1,000, or 5 minutes looking at each one of the 4,000 or 8,000?
And is your example a plea, which is what we have here? Is that what your example arises out of, just so I understand what you're asking?
No, it isn't necessarily a plea. It arises out of actually the footnote in footnote 3 in the reply brief of the defendant when he cites this case that's pending in the Court of Appeals. I don't know, is it McDonald or something like that, that raises the concern about these larger numbers. There it was both charged and uncharged. We don't have that issue before us. But so that's where my concern arises out of. Can you answer my question?
Sure. Well, again, as far as the read-ins are concerned, the judge is going to have, in my view, probably sufficient information pertaining to each one of those images. And so, you know, based on the complaint, based on the information and the petitioner's, plea in this case. But I think that the judge, under the statute, the judge is required to review each one of those images. It's the judge that's required to determine by a preponderance of the evidence whether each one of those images does in fact, rise to the level of being associated with the crime. So, you know, obviously my 5 minute, estimation as to how long the analysis is going to take, that certainly may differ. It may not always take 5 minutes. It may take longer. If the defendant actually objects to whether or not a particular photo is in fact associated with the crime, you know, that one photo could take 20 minutes. It just depends on the facts of the case. But yeah, I do believe that under the plain language of the statute, that the judge is in fact required to analyze each one of these images individually. And I think it would be important to allow the defendant, especially on uncharged, not in plea cases, but in uncharged images that this potentially would be, the surcharge would be subject to. I think the defendant would need to have an opportunity to perhaps contest whether or not a particular image is in fact associated or not associated with the crime. So I don't believe that it would be sufficient, especially with uncharged images, for, say, the individual that drafted the affidavit supporting the complaint to come in and say, you know what, I found 1,000 images, each one of them contains child pornography. I don't think that is sufficient in these cases. And again, I don't think it's, in fact, fair to the defendant to allow that to occur. I think the defendant would need to have an opportunity to contest. Now, in this particular case, the defendant did not contest any of the images, did not contest the fact that any of those images were in fact associated with the crime, at least at trial or at the sentencing. But yeah, I think that the plain language of the statute does require the judge to go through each one of those, maybe not for 5 minutes, but does require the judge to go through each one of those images individually and make a determination as to whether or not they are child pornography, whether they were possessed by the defendant, and whether they're associated with the crime.
So the only limitations you're saying that are placed on this statute with respect to a determination of whether it's excessive are practical ones, because that's the only ones I hear you making.
Well, no, I think that the operation of the statute would be a limitation, and the Eighth Amendment potentially would be an operation or a limiting principle here. Again, you know, the monies that are raised from this surcharge are intended to cover costs that are high. Providing, as Justice Kurofsky had pointed out, the money goes toward investigation of crimes that involve child pornography. And with the number of images that an individual has, those investigations become potentially more and more complicated. And with the number of images that an individual has, the number of victims would obviously increase. In this particular case, although there were 14 images, there were more than 14 victims, because at least one of those images had two children involved in it. So now you're talking about, although it's only one image, now you're talking about two children who potentially would need to have or seek victim services in the future, potentially for life, based on the sexual assault that occurred to them. And again, I think that that's the reason, it's important for the judge to analyze each one of these. It's important for the surcharge to not have a hard and fast limit on it, because the purpose of the surcharge, based on the high costs that surcharge is intended to cover, it wouldn't be appropriate to put a hard and fast cap on it, in my view. With the remaining time that I have left over, I would just like to briefly address the remaining issue or the punishment issue that I haven't covered. I think I covered it fairly well in the brief. I see this time has stopped, so I'll defer.
Okay, very good. Attorney August, are you prepared for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please begin.
Thank you. So I think it's really important to point out that what we're doing here is we're interpreting this statute, and we're governed by the words that the legislature has chosen. We're not necessarily governed by pragmatic principles or by these kind of hypothetical considerations that are raised by opposing counsel. I also think it's notable, and I'm a little confused by opposing counsel's position, because opposing counsel appears to take the position that the excessive fines clause could be a limitation here. So I don't know if there's a concession that at some point, based on a plain reading of the statute, if we impose $1 million worth of surcharges, it becomes a punishment such that this person could have an Eighth Amendment claim, but yet it's not a punishment on the face of it, because I don't know why. So that's problematic to me as well. And I'm not really sure what to do with that, but I just wanted to bring that to the court's attention. At the end of the day, as I stated, what we're talking about here is the words of the legislature. And we're talking about two different issues, but it's relevant to both issues. So I think
let me just ask something before you run out of time. Mr. Mullenbach's position is that for a judge to determine whether an image is associated with a crime by a preponderance, that the judge would need to look at every one of the images and make a decision. And Justice Ann Walsh Bradley said, You could have a hearing. You could have someone testify. You could knock this off in 20 minutes with an expert. What's your position on what a judge would need to do procedurally in order to make the determination under the statute?
So with the caveat that it's slightly outside of what I've briefed in this case, I think the state, I mean, it's interesting that the state has a very, I think, charitable view of the preponderance standard, that I don't think the preponderance standard necessarily requires a circuit court to sit down and look at and scrutinize each image for 5 minutes in order to determine. I mean, I think that this court's been clear in its cases on experts that an expert could be qualified. And certainly the DOJ, as Your Honor is aware, has those individuals who work in the forensic computer department who generate these reports that are relied on in these cases. And an expert could generate a report and could testify at a hearing and could opine. And, you know, without foreclosing an issue in another case, preponderance is a low standard. And I think Justice Hagedorn is correct that if an expert is going to come in and is going to give that opinion, that in my opinion, I've looked at this and there's 4,500 images of child pornography, then under the state's reading, I don't see any intervening opportunity for discretion. If that is the evidence that's presented, and there's really
Would the defendant have the right to cross-examine the expert? Certainly no counsel is going to let an expert come in and make that testimony for 20 minutes and say, oh, good, I agree. I mean, defense counsel will try to get underneath that testimony, or at least that's been my experience in all the records I've looked at. That's what, I mean, certainly you would as defense counsel. You're very vigorous on appeal.
Well, certainly defense counsel could. I'm only indicating that if the circuit court were to, as the fact finder, as the person listening to the testimony of the expert, if the circuit court were to make that finding that I find that this expert is credible and persuasive and found that that testimony should be credited, then it does seem like that would appear to satisfy the preponderance standard. And then at that point, I don't know where there's an intervening act of discretion for a circuit court to say, well, I accept your testimony that there's 4,500 images, but I want to use my discretion and I only want to apply 1,000 images, or I only want to apply 500 images.
Well, one would think that defense counsel might want to represent his client and get the court to look further than just listening to an expert's testimony. If defense counsel says, well, some of these are not child pornography, as I understand from opposing counsel, is the case before us. So all of that would come out in a hearing, but just because an expert says it doesn't make it so. The trial court has got to make a determination, and I can't imagine a trial court would not listen to defense counsel or permit defense counsel to show that some of these images actually are not child pornography. So, I mean, I think, you know, we can get so doggone hypothetical, we lose track of the world, in my view. I mean, I can't imagine having a trial where defense counsel wouldn't have that permission. So what is your position on the defense counsel's participation?
So I think obviously defense counsel could probe and could cross-examine and would have the ability to make arguments that, you know, potentially, I guess, the actors were above age or that something wasn't necessarily child pornography. But I think realistically, as we know from these child pornography cases, if we are having someone being convicted of possession of child pornography, we're not usually dealing with edge cases by the time that we get to sentencing. And so I don't know that it would be a situation where there would be, frankly, all that much dispute. There certainly would be some, and, you know, the circuit court would have to sort out the factual matter. But once the circuit court sorted out the factual matter, my point is the circuit court wouldn't have an intervening opportunity to set aside the facts and decide how many images to impose, if that makes sense under the state's reading. So,
okay, fine. Thank you. That does answer my question. Thank you both for a very good argument, and your briefs were also very helpful. We are now going to take a brief recess so that we can get set up for our next case of the morning. We are adjourned.